Welcome to Sentient Development, the podcast.
Hello and welcome once again to Sentient Developments, the podcast. My name is George Dvorsky and you're listening to the podcast of my blog, Sentient Developments. The blog, for those who may not be familiar, and of course this podcast as well, we cover such things as futurism and transhumanism, issues as they pertain to such things as bioethics and foresight, risk, new technologies, and of course the sociological impacts. And a particular concern for me is in anything that has to do with the instantiation or the existence of a person and personhood. And I'm always on the lookout for examples of that, whether they be animal friends or whether it be in pending technologies such as artificial intelligence, hence the name Sentient Developments. And pretty much any subject for that matter is on the table. Basically, I can use this as a soundboard and a soapbox to talk about whatever it is that interests me at any given time. But ultimately, it always does tend to reflect on our trajectory into the future and how sociological changes or technological changes are set to impact upon us. And most importantly, of course, as a transhumanist, I am concerned about such things as the improvement of human capacities and performance. Things like intelligence augmentation, memory enhancement, and of course, life extension. And I'm also, I guess, interested in how transhumanism can be applied to our daily lives. So very much rooted into the here and now and concerned about how we can use the technologies that are available at our disposal today and use them to enhance our performance, optimize human potential and our genetic potential. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And today's episode, I'm going to devote the entire hour to Burning Man and my visit to Burning Man in Black Rock City in late August. And you might think, well, what has that got to do with transhumanism or futurism? Well, stay tuned and find out. You'd be surprised. I found that the experience was perhaps one of the most science fiction-like experiences that I've ever had in my life. And the whole idea behind Burning Man and the creation of an alternative society, this kind of vacation world, if you will, is of definite, I think, importance to transhumanists and futurists, particularly those who envision the creation of novel societies and alternative societies and even just simply alternative modes of living. So yeah, I'm going to devote the entire hour to that topic. But before I do, I would like to respond to a question from an audience member that I got this week. Not just any old audience member, a very devoted fan, happens to be my dad. So my father had a particular concern with my claims as it pertains to the Paleolithic diet, this idea that ancestral health is where it's at, and it's by eating and even to a certain degree living like our Paleolithic ancestors that we stand to live in better health than honoring what modernity has bestowed upon us. So most specifically, of course, what the agricultural revolution has done to human civilization. So in particular, my dad's concern is that back in, and by the way, it's not just my dad's concern, this is a common criticism or objection that's levied at the paleo movement. And that's the idea that, wait a minute, hold on, isn't it true, or weren't we told that life expectancy back then was around 30 years? And even apparently back into the 18th and 19th centuries, when the Europeans came here, they observed that the expectancy for the native hunters and gatherers was just around 40 to 45 years, where a 50-year-old was already considered to be an old man. And such things as having either no teeth or no strength, living kind of like this so-called short brutish existence. Now, as it stands, we're finding that the anthropological evidence does not necessarily support this claim. And I'm going to address a couple of things in particular about this. First of all, we have to, I think, make it very clear as to why we're referring to Paleolithic and Neolithic societies, and not make the mistake of conflating what it means to the individual in these societies and what it means for human civilization as a whole. And what I mean by that is the agricultural revolution was absolutely fantastic for human civilization, and it arguably has provided for virtually everything that, you know, we've come to know as a civilization in terms of the benefits, everything from at least what we lead to believe in terms of leisure time and the expression of you know, our artistic creativity, and of course the onset of technologies in the industrial revolution and so on. So while it's pretty undeniable that the agricultural revolution had a rather cataclysmic impact, a paradigmatic change in terms of what it meant to the human species, the same cannot be said about the agricultural revolution and its impact on human health and well-being. And this is where it helps to defer a lot to the findings of anthropologists, who are basically, they tend to be in agreement that modern lifestyle is actually, we're not so well suited for it relative to, you know, where our bodies are in terms of what we were actually designed evolutionarily to deal with. So we are, even though it's the year 2011, we are still biologically, for the most part, hunter-gatherers in our genetic lineage. We are kind of meant that to be kind of living in that kind of an environment. We're not meant to be sedentary. Our bodies were never evolved to eat things like grains and obviously the highly processed foods that we have that are absolutely inundated with chemicals and so on. So already we know, it's just intuitively we get this sense that just by going back to kind of an ancestral mode of eating, in which we're eating whole foods that we could either hunt or gather, that our bodies were definitely evolved over the course of hundreds of thousands of years to be able to digest and properly metabolize that food. But now, one thing I'd like to do is actually defer a little bit here to Rob Wolf. And for those who don't know, Rob Wolf is one of the foremost thinkers when it comes to the Paleolithic diet. And he has a chapter in his book, The Paleo Solution, in which he addresses this subject specifically. And if I could just actually quote a little bit from this book, because he puts it much better than I could here. And that is that what he says is that our hunter-gatherer ancestors were remarkably healthy. They were as tall or taller than modern Americans and Europeans, which is a sign that they ate a very nutritious diet. They were virtually free of cavities and bone malformations that are common with malnutrition. Despite a lack of medical care, they had remarkably low infant mortality rates, yet had better than 10% of their population live into their 60s. So when we say, that was the quote from the Rob Wolf book. Now, when we say that life expectancy, for example, was 30 years or 35 years, what we often fail to take into account when we're considering those figures is that doesn't necessarily mean that you died of old age at that time. What it typically meant was that was the median age in which you could expect your life to go up until. And the reason why it was so low was due to such things as infant mortality, the onset of disease that was incurable or could not be dealt with. And we think, for example, some of the benefits that a Neolithic society has, or rather a more modern civilization has bestowed upon us, where we have access to such things as immunizations, as the kind of health care that we have, such things as doctors and hospitals, so specialists who actually deal with the problems that we had. Let's say it's resetting a broken bone, or even let's say if you were cutting and bleeding hopelessly, you can get patched up and even get a blood transfusion. And of course, the whole theory behind hygiene and washing hands, and surgery. Surgery is an absolutely massive one. So in the past, if you had, let's say, appendicitis, you'd be finished. Today, appendicitis is just a rather routine procedure that allows you then to live on to have a longer life. So these are factors that contributed back then to what you could say was a life expectancy to around 30 years. The fact of the matter being, though, is if you actually looked, though, at the individual hunter-gatherer, that you were looking at a relatively healthy person. Now, Rob Wolf in the Paleo Solution does provide some actual examples. And he references a book entitled Nutritional Anthropology, Contemporary Approaches to Diet and Culture. And there's a chapter in that book called Nutrition and Health in Agriculturalists and Hunter-Gatherers, a case study of two prehistoric populations. And it's an analysis of two peoples who lived near the Ohio River Valley, and they were farmers who were referred to as the Hardin Village Group. They lived in the area about 500 years ago. And then there are the hunter-gatherers who are given the name Indian Knoll, and this is for the area in which their remains were found, and they lived in the area about 3,000 to 5,000 years ago. And the sites are significant in that each one produces a large number of skeletal remains. And for statistical purposes, this makes information derived from the sites very compelling. Now, the agriculture-based Hardin villagers, they subsisted mainly on corn, beans, and squash, which is typical of many groups of Native Americans, including the Pima of Mexico and Arizona, where the hunter-gatherers, on the other hand, of the Indian Knolls, they subsisted on a mixed foraging diet of meat, wild fruit, fish, and shellfish. So again, here we have your traditional paleo individuals, and then you had a kind of a farmer type, group. And now the anthropologists have been able to do a bit of a statistical analysis on it. So here's what they found. They found that the hunter-gatherers showed almost no cavities, whereas the farmers showed almost 7 cavities on average per person. The hunter-gatherers showed significantly less bone malformations consistent with malnutrition. That means that the hunter-gatherers were much better fed. The hunter-gatherers also showed a remarkably lower rate of infant mortality relative to the farmers. And the most significant difference was between the ages of 2 and 4, when malnutrition is particularly damaging to children. In addition, the hunter-gatherers were on average healthier, as evidenced by decreased rates of bone malformations typical of infectious disease. And they had on average longer lives than the farmers, and they showed little to no sign of iron, calcium, and protein deficiencies, whereas this was common in the farmers. So I'll leave it at that for now. So again, we have this kind of intuitive sense that eating in a way that our bodies had evolved to eat makes kind of just sense. And that by continuing to throw all these things into our body that we're never intended for our bodies to ingest, it kind of just makes sense that's kind of a non-starter. And it can certainly account for a lot of the modern diseases that we are witnessing today, most severely in the obesity epidemic, and even just in other malaises and diseases such as cancer, heart disease, and so on. And more importantly, though, of course, is the evidence that we're now actually just finding through our research and through the science and through the anthropological study, whereas we're just simply finding through our the study of the bones and the remains and the artifacts that there's quite incontrovertible evidence that the paleo ancestor was physically healthier than those living in a Neolithic styled society. So I hope that kind of answers your question, Dad. And of course, for those who had similar concerns. And again, very happy to keep this conversation going and address any concerns or questions that you might have about the paleo diet. Okay, so today's episode, as mentioned in the introduction, I'm going to devote it to Burning Man. And I had my very first visit to Burning Man this past summer. And it was in late August, and that's typically when it's held. And it was, I would say, one of the most profound experiences of my life and certainly a highlight of the year. And I've got so much to say and so much to talk about it that I should have no problem filling in the hour. And my only concern is that this might get a bit rambly and jumping from topic to topic, but hopefully by the end of it, it all kind of will come together and make a little bit of sense. I think maybe the best way to go about it is just to simply address it from the perspective of my coming there and visiting it for the first time. So I went with a friend, a very good friend of mine named J.R. LaFontaine, and he lives with me here in the GTA. And we had talked about this for a while, and finally we got our act together and we decided that we were going to do something about it and get the tickets, get the plane tickets, and plan it out and just bite the bullet and do it. Because I had quite literally been considering a Burning Man trip for about 5 years or so, and finally decided, you know, stop procrastinating, just, you know, organize yourself and save some money and just go ahead and do it. So we bought the tickets back earlier in the year, and we kind of committed ourselves to it, and started to have to plan for what was not going to be an easy trip. So Burning Man, what is it? It kind of helps maybe to kind of describe what it is at this point. Burning Man is a festival that happens once a year. It only lasts for a week, and it happens in the middle of the Black Rock Desert in Nevada, which, if you take a look at Nevada, it's pretty much right smack dab in the middle of it. It's, or at least certainly in the grounds itself where the festival takes place is definitely right in the middle of the Black Rock Desert. So it's in an extremely desolate and remote area. And the conditions there are quite severe. You are having to deal with desert conditions. So there's extreme heat during the day, extreme cold at night. And I'll get to that just a little later on as my story unfolds here. During the day, you can expect sandstorms to kind of sweep up, and the dust is absolutely ubiquitous. It just gets into everything and everywhere, and it provides for a rather challenging variable as you're dealing with it while you're there. And so you are basically camping in the desert for a week, and you have to prepare accordingly. So you can imagine us coming in from Toronto, having to fly in. We flew into San Francisco, that you can't necessarily bring all of the supplies that you're kind of hoping to bring in. But we did do our best. We managed to fly with as many items as we could. Like I managed to fly with a sleeping bag and a little pillow, and kind of like basic needs. And then once we got into San Francisco, we were able to do some more shopping. We basically devoted an entire day to picking up those things that we couldn't fly with, that were either too unwieldy or just not, you know, not really necessary to be packed. And we also rented a cargo van, a nice big white cargo van, that obviously provided for our means of transportation, but it also gave us a place where we could store all of our stuff and bring it into the Black Rock Desert. So we departed from San Francisco in the wee hours of the morning on our first day. We left at about 3 in the morning, and we started to drive. We drove through California, through Northern California, and then we crossed over the mountains, and we entered into Nevada. And pretty much immediately, once we had entered into Nevada, the landscape started to change pretty dramatically. We went from this kind of very beautiful, lush forest to this kind of this arid, hot, desert-like environment in which the lushness had completely disappeared, and it was replaced by this kind of yellowish-white sand and soil. We made one last stop in Reno, Nevada to pick some very last-minute supplies, and then that was pretty much it. We obviously made sure that we had all of our basic needs met for desert survival, in addition to some obviously non-perishable food items. So we packed a lot of things like dried fruits and nuts, beef jerky. But of course, you had to pack in a lot of water, because another thing about Burning Man, as it is this kind of festival that erupts in the middle of the desert quite spontaneously, there's no real infrastructure there. No one's going to provide for you. And as I'll get into a little bit later, there's no economy there either, meaning that money is no good in Burning Man. It relies on what's called a gift economy. So one of the ideas behind Burning Man is this whole issue of radical self-reliance. So you basically have to be quite responsible for yourself. And so we made sure, of course, that we had our basic needs. And they did recommend, if I remember correctly, 1.5 gallons of water per person per day. So we made sure that we had that and then some. Because once you're out there, you're out there. And there's no, like I said, store anywhere nearby to pick up some extra water. So we started to, once we were done with in Reno, we started to make our way a little bit further to the east, and then we started to head due north deep into the Black Rock Desert. And we were driving and driving and driving, and the environment started to get more severe as we drove. So the less and less foliage, more and more of the sand. And in fact, it got to a point where there suddenly we had was the emergence of open desert, or what's referred to as the playas, which is just these real flat lands of desert, the kind of what you'd kind of expect to see on a flat desert floor, but none of the sand dune type things, just flat desert and hard as a rock. Which is a kind of another interesting thing is these kinds of intangibles that you don't necessarily know. One of the smart things that JR and I did prior to going to Burning Man was we attended a kind of newbie picnic where they primed us on some things that might be unexpected. And one of them was the how hard the playa ground is, and that if you bring your regular tent pegs, your plastic pegs, you're never gonna spike them into the ground, that they're just gonna snap because the sand is so, or the ground is so solid. So what we did is on the advice of a lot of people, we made these rebar spikes. And brought hammers to drill them into the ground. So that's the kind of just these weird elements that you're constantly having to deal with. So we continued to drive up north, and we managed to pass the very last town prior to Black Rock City, which is called Gerlach. Gerlach is a mining town where they mine for gypsum, which is a material that you find in drywall. But because of the festival and because of the popularity of the festival, in which roughly 55,000 people stream through there, both on their way in and their way out, it's kind of created a bit of a boom economy as it pertains to the festival. While the festival might only last about a week, there's certainly activity both in the weeks preceding it and preceding it. And there are a number of individuals that were taking as much of an advantage as they could with all the people coming through, setting up either little restaurant stands or selling merchandise, just to kind of, even though you could, for example, buy a bike for $50, which is kind of like your last chance to bring a used bike into the festival should you need one. And so we kind of stocked up a little bit there, got last minute supplies, and then we started to go once again into the desert. And at this point, it was very cool. Basically, it was a convoy of cars as far as the eye could see. And because it was desert and because there's no buildings or trees or anything, you could see so far over off to the horizon. And there were some spectacular views of the roads ahead of us, as you could just see cars as far as the eye could see, RVs, vans, trucks, cars, campers, buses, and pulling trailers. And again, it was just this, you knew they were all going to the same place. Everybody was going to the one location to have this kind of celebration for the week. And as a first timer, I have to admit that now we were so far from anything, and all I could see was desert around me. I started to get the butterflies, and I started to get quite nervous. And I remember thinking to myself, "Man, oh man, what have I gotten myself into?" That this was truly, it's one thing to think about it and kind of have this kind of abstract idea that, yeah, you're going to be in the desert. It's another thing to quite suddenly find yourself in that situation and not having a whole lot of experience with that particular kind of environment and living in it. But I thought to myself, you know what, people do this every year, people that are, less hardy and less healthy and, much higher maintenance than you are. And they survive it, you can too. And that kind of pushed me forward and gave me that bit of boost of confidence. So we finally arrived at the area in which they do the processing for Burning Man. And at this point, it was kind of an unexpected, at least for me anyways, an unexpected amount of time that we had to wait to get processed. I think we arrived around 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the afternoon, and it took us, I think, between 4 to 5 hours of just waiting in line to get processed. The lanes were about 4 cars wide, and the cars were moving so slowly that you could basically just stand next to the car and just, slowly inch your way forward. But that was kind of that was an experience unto itself, because it was in the middle of the afternoon. The sun was beating down on our van. You just kind of once in a while like to step outside and just feel that wind on your face and the sand and the dust, and even just talk to the neighbors next to you and see how they're doing. But what was also particularly fun about that moment, those 4 or 5 hours, was Black Rock City, they had, I think, at least 2 radio stations. We managed to tap into one of them, and these guys were absolutely hilarious. They played some fantastic music, and they basically kept us company and kept us sane as we were kind of waiting in our cars in the desert to get through the line. And that helped tremendously. And I remember eventually I found the guys and I found their booth in the Black Rock city. And I shook their hands and thanked them very much for what they were doing. So once we got to the processing station, what they do there, they're really what they're checking for. Obviously, they want your ticket, and but they're also checking to make sure that you bring in no stowaways. They want to make sure you're not bringing any firearms and anything else that might be illegal and dangerous. Another thing that they're not allowed, they don't allow in Black Rock City, are pets. No dogs, no cats. And I think that's probably a good thing. It was certainly a nice not having to deal with that element there. And once we were cleared through there, then we went through the second processing station. Now it was kind of fun because now we're definitely we were in and into the city and we're all green lighted. And we go to the greeters, and the greeters basically ask you, you know, are you a first timer? And in this case, JR and I, we were first timers. So what they made us do is kind of like an initiation. They made us fall into the ground and do sand angels, like not like snow angels, but sand angels. So immediately hadn't even got there, and I'm already absolutely covered in sand and dust. And then they had a bell, and you had a mallet, and you had to yell, you know, I'm a Burning Man virgin no more. And you smashed the mallet on the bell, and it gave a rather a hearty ring, and it was really, really, really quite spectacular. So we got back into our van, and off we went to find our tribe, if you will. Now, this is worth noting, is that I stayed with, or we stayed with Future Camp. And Future Camp has been around now for many years. I believe it was founded by John Smart, who's a friend and colleague of mine, and he recommended that we stay there. But unfortunately, because he's getting married, he could not be part of the camp. But there were on the order of about 50 to 60 other futurists who were part of this camp. And that was, I have to say, absolutely perfect for me. This was absolutely some of the best and finest people that I've managed to spend some time with. And even if this was not Burning Man, it would have been wonderful just to spend a week with the future campers themselves. Strangely, I didn't know the vast majority of them. I knew some by name, but most of them I did not know. But certainly after the end of the week, I was very comfortable to call them my friends, and certainly have managed to keep in touch with several of them through things like Facebook and Twitter and so on. But I do believe that, just kind of like in hindsight, my recommendation to any of you who might be considering a trip to go to Burning Man is if you can take part in a camp, a kind of tribe, if you will, it doesn't matter if it's a four or five people or like us, 60, 70 people, make sure that you do so and that you are hanging out with a very like-minded people. It will greatly enhance your experience there. And what was particularly fascinating and wonderful about a future camp was that it brought together futurists from pretty much around the world. I mean, the vast majority of them were from the Bay Area, but for the most part, we came from pretty much all walks of life. But what kind of bound us together was, you know, the transhumanist or the futurist aspect, or the rationalist aspect, and so on. So we managed to go to our future camp. And the future camp was in an area referred to as Plygon Village. And within Plygon Village, there were other, I guess, somewhat like-minded camps. There was Yurtopia, which was a camp basically that consisted of yurts. And our friend Todd Huffman was definitely in and amongst that group. And that was a very techno-savvy and very sophisticated group, particularly when it came to survival and setting up their yurts. And they had these are guys that have backgrounds with NASA and DARPA, for example. So you can imagine what they had set up. There was also in behind us were the Bayesian rationalists, and Michael Vassar of the Singularity Institute was in and amongst them. And that was kind of fascinating to hang out with them and share in that particular subset. So again, just when you think you can get specific enough, you can get even more specific. So there was literally a Bayesian rationalist camp at Burning Man this year. And basically, whatever your imagination can come up with or whatever your interest is, you can set up a camp and find like-minded individuals to hang out. Now, we were at Future Camp, so that's pretty broad, a broad-ranging, I guess, group there. So everything from transhumanists right through to just simply rationalists and people that are techno-friendly and optimistic enough. And JR and I, we set up our camp there. He had his own tent. I decided I was going to sleep in the van, which in hindsight, I'm not so sure if I would do that again or not. One thing I can tell you, and they warned you ahead of time about how cold it gets in the desert, but it got down in terms of Celsius into single digit numbers. And there were at least a couple of nights where I was shivering in my sleeping bag, my useless sleeping bag. I'll have you know, I'm definitely not going to use that one again. Where I just could not wait for the morning to come because it was just so unbelievably cold. And the ironic thing is that once the morning does come and once that sun creeps over the horizon, boy, the sun just starts to beat down instantaneously, and it heats up real fast. So it's a land of extremes. You know, it's kind of a no-win situation in terms of your climate control. I will say, though, one of the nicest times, though, is at sunset, where you do have a period of about 3 to 4 hours of relative sanity in terms of the temperature, and it's really quite lovely at that time. Not only does it kind of look aesthetically quite beautiful as the sun is setting and the light changes, but the temperature is very manageable, and you're getting ready for that you're also excited knowing that you're about to hit the nightlife as it is in Black Rock City. So that's how we got into camp. And now what Burning Man really is, I mean, I have to be honest, I kind of had, I think, a naive impression of what it was about and what I was about to get myself into. And I, from what the pictures that I'd seen and from the accounts that I had heard, I understood it to be a celebration or even just a rather massive party. But it took me a couple of days to quickly realize that it was more than just a big party in the desert, that there's some elements to Burning Man and the whole Black Rock City idea that hit far deeper and are more richer in terms of an experience than I would have ever imagined. Everything from how it kind of restores your sense of dignity and the worth of the individual through to even a sense of spirituality that's there. There's even such things as just seeing, it kind of restores your faith in humanity when you can see the city survive for about a week with very little infrastructure, with very little oversight and regulation. It's really quite remarkable. So what happens is, once, like I mentioned, this festival happens once a year, and it's in the middle of the desert, and the organizers there, they do set a plot of area where you set up your camp. So if you've seen a picture of Black Rock City, from above or from space, it's like this crescent C shape. And it's meant to be kind of like this circular structure, and it's organized like a clock is organized in terms of understanding the orientation. So there's the one end is 12 o'clock and its opposite end is 6, and then on the sides you've got 3 o'clock and 6 o'clock, and then of course you have all the gradients in between. As for the roads themselves, they number A through H, I think, or G or H. But each of the roads is given you don't refer to it as A or D or so on. You refer to it by name. So, for example, we were at Future Camp where were we? We were at 4:45 and Engagement. So if you think of a clock, imagine 4:45 on the clock. And then E would have been the A, B, C, D, E, the fifth row coming out from the center. So that's the intersection, and that's. It took a couple of days for me to kind of get a feel for that. So somebody would say, you know, meet me at, you know, D and 9:30, and be like, whoa, like what does that mean relative to where I'm standing right now? And imagine you're standing, for example, in the middle of the desert floor, somewhere, you know, near the temple, for example. You kind of have to quickly orient yourself and figure out, okay, how do I actually get there? Where does that actually exist in this kind of clock-like structure? And in terms of, with everybody setting up their camps and setting up their RVs and their trailers and their tents, you do have this kind of city emerge from the dust. It's really an amazing thing to see. And it becomes a very vibrant city for the course of the week. And 55,000 people are really who were part of the festival this year. It was the first time that it was ever sold out. And in terms of the infrastructure, again, aside from, let's say, establishing the plots where you set yourself up, they do have porta potties there where you go to the bathroom, and other than that, you're pretty much on your own. There are no such things there, for example, as garbage cans and receptacles. You are 100% responsible for your own waste. Whatever you bring in, you have to bring back home. And in fact, there's even a term for garbage that's been left on the ground. It's called MOOP, MOOP, and it stands for matter out of place. And the idea here is that if you ever should see that, some moop, just pick it up. Not because it's necessarily yours, but even if it's somebody else's, just to keep the place clean. And there's a very good reason for this, not just from a common sense perspective and just because you don't want the place to be dirty where you live. But the state of Nevada, because this takes place in a state park, they do a review at the end of each festival in terms of the cleanliness and to make sure that the campers didn't leave too many a lot of garbage behind and waste. And in fact, every year, Black Rock City is actually, you know, is in danger of, in fact, being shut down on account of there being too much garbage. So what I will say is that Future Camp, in 2010, they received a yellow rating at the end, which is not good. But this year we received a green rating, which means obviously that's the best that we can get. We kept it unbelievably clean. We spent a very good amount of time during teardown to make sure that every scrap of dust and or every scrap of garbage and a bolt or a twist tie or a sparkle or whatever it might be was picked up and thrown into the garbage. So we definitely left no trace. But it is pretty amazing when you have these kind of this simple set of rules and you have this kind of attitude, this kind of code, expected code of conduct that at least amongst this particular population, this particular demographic, the level of adherence was pretty amazing. And I met one woman, for example, who on one night, just out of the goodness of her own heart, I'm not sure what you'd say, why she did this, but she picked up 65 cigarette butts. And another friend of mine, she had just this own internal rule where if for every piece of garbage that she dropped and that was she was unable to recover it. You have to understand with the wind blowing the way it does and this the chaos that that it's there. You can't, despite your best intentions, always claim your garbage. So her rule was that for every piece that she lost or picked up, that she'd have to pick up two that she found of somebody else's. So what you end up having is a rather remarkably clean city for the duration that it lasts. And that's kind of another interesting point about all this is you do quickly learn that there is a kind of code of conduct, and it really does work in a really wonderful sort of way. Everybody's so polite, everybody's so kind, everybody's looking out for everybody. And a very good friend of mine who went last year for the first time, or 2010 for the first time, she got quite lost and even quite panicked, and she just started to shout out for help, and was immediately swarmed by friendly burners who were like, "Okay, what's going on? Where, you know, what can we do to help?" And it's that kind of an attitude that is definitely, you cannot help but notice it, and it's so unbelievably infectious. And even you saw these kids there, like these college kids who were clearly there to kind of have this spring break party experience. You could kind of see it on their face that this was maybe a bit more than they had expected in terms of a place to kind of reconnect with your humanity and live a kind of in a way that was a bit unconventional and quite civilized. In terms of also the infrastructure, there are in terms of, let's say, like the policing, if you will, or the security that's there, there are Nevada state troopers that are there, and you do see them. They walk in pairs, or they're walking, or they're driving around in their vehicles. They're kind of like a necessary part of Burning Man. I'm sure that if the organizers had their way, they would not want that element there, because it is kind of meant to be an escape from the so-called real world, or as burners like to refer to, a default society. That just for 1 week, it'd be nice to could be completely divorced from everything that we come to know in terms of human civilization, aside from who we are and what we bring in. But it can't be helped. That's the state of Nevada insists on it, and the state troopers are there, and they're mostly looking for things like drugs and those sorts of things. Now, that being said, there is a kind of internal, policing is not the right word, but burners have what are referred to as rangers. And what the rangers are, a group of volunteers. They're burners, not unlike anybody else. Nobody's getting paid to do this, although they do get some privileges in terms of, I think it might even be free admission, but don't quote me on that. I'm not totally sure. But they certainly get either discounted admission or, and they get a lot of meals that are paid for. And you don't have to be a ranger, you know, for the whole 6 or 7 days of the festival. You can just choose whatever shifts you want. And what you do is you put on this kind of ranger outfit and you just walk around and be helpful. You are, as a ranger, you have no authority, none more than any other burner, but you're there to kind of answer questions, to help out and guide people, direct people, let them know, let's say, where the medical tent is. So again, that's another thing that's there. There's medical tents. I actually had to use a medical tent once when I cut myself on one of the art cars, which I can kind of talk about a bit later. And another thing about the rangers is they will not tell you to not do something. So let's say they see you climbing on an art installation and you're putting your life in peril. They won't shout out at you and say, "You shouldn't be doing that. Get down." They don't want to kind of inhibit your experience there. But what they'll do is they will hang out and wait for something potentially bad to happen. And should that happen, they'll obviously arrange to have you helped out by the medical facility or what have you. And some of them are also, there's also various levels of rangers, and some of them are trained, for example, in having to deal with psychological breakdowns, to deal with people, for example, who are having really bad trips. They can talk them down and so on. A lot of people have emotional breakdowns. Again, it's so hard to describe this sometimes, like if you've not been there, to understand how emotionally overwhelming the experience can be. But I can understand that some people could have a complete psychological breakdown, emotional breakdown, as they're kind of figuring things out. So out of the box in terms of what they're used to. So the rangers are there to kind of help people emotionally as well. So where do I go from here? Now, the gift economy, that's an interesting thing. And it like I mentioned, that money is no good at Burning Man. And except at Center Camp, where you can use money to buy coffee and ice, which I kind of find pretty interesting. I guess talk about your basic needs, that when it comes down to it, we need our coffee and we need our ice. But aside from that, money is no good, and and it's not a, don't misunderstand me as well, it's not a barter economy. Nobody's trading anything. Like, you're not saying, give me this and I'll give you that. Basically, it's you give strictly, just giving with no expectation of receiving anything in return. And still kind of puzzled as to why this works so well. I'm not sure if it's because it's short term or because of the attitude or whatever, but it really, you know, it's part, an indelible part of the experience, because people are just giving so much. And the city itself is highly functional as a result. So you had, like I said earlier, there's a couple of radio stations there. There were so many bars where you could just go and get drinks. There are... there's a dating service there where you could you go in there and you try to find, you put down your parameters or your what you're interested in a little bit about yourself, and they try to match you up with another person who's at Black Rock City for that week. There's even a functional post office, so you could quite literally mail a letter to somebody in the city, and it just goes on and on and on. There's a hair washing station and so on, places to do yoga. There were places for, I mean, there were meetups there for polyamory groups. There were meetups there for writer's craft. And even we ourselves at Future Camp, we had what were called Inceptions. And basically, it was a speaker's series. And this is where I, for example, was able to give back to the community. My gifting, if you will, to the community was the talks that I gave. And I gave three talks in particular at our tent. And we had some people just kind of come in who had no idea what our camp was, who we are. They just saw that we had an audience and people were talking. And they just parked their bike or whatever, and they just sat down in a lawn chair, and they just hung out for the afternoon listening to us futurists talk about this, that, and the other thing. So the gift economy, definitely an interesting part about it. And what was also kind of neat about the gift economy was some of the gifts that you got served more as even as souvenirs. And something that I did not know, and I will definitely prepare for the next time I go, is even some of these souvenirs can be very touching, because you meet these people and you bond with them. Even if it's, you just met somebody, let's say in the middle of the desert at 2 a.m. In an art car, and you suddenly shared an experience, or you kind of really, you know, had a great conversation with this person, and they'll leave you with like a little trinket or a little thing to remember them by. And that becomes a rather powerful souvenir when all is said and done. And that definitely happened on a number of occasions. And I had this kind of little box of things that I started to collect and I brought home to me as my little souvenir case. And I kind of felt a little bad that I didn't kind of return those kinds of things. So, but next time, you know, this is how you you do it right. Next time, again, I'll definitely have a little bit more to add to the experience for others. And again, this is kind of this funny thing about gifting, is this feeling that you do want to, you know, you really do want to contribute back to this society as it exists for the short duration. And the festival itself, you can really say that there were two aspects to it, in terms of the daytime and in terms of the nighttime. As there, you cannot even begin to compare the day with the night. And during the day, for example, like you have such things as the talks. That's pretty common. And it's also a good time to just walk around and meet people and just kind of check things out. It's also a good time to go to the temple. I'll just briefly talk about the temple. This is another thing that completely caught me off guard that I did not expect. And I knew that there was a temple there. And I had a friend give me an envelope, and she said, make sure that this gets burnt at the temple. I didn't really quite understand what that meant. And even when I went there on the first day, I think I went to the temple on the very first day of the festival. It was this absolutely beautiful wooden structure, and it was massive. In fact, I heard that while it stood, because it burnt, they burned it down at the end of the festival, that while it stood, it was the largest temporary wooden structure on the planet. So that's how impressive it was. And it was pristine and beautiful, but it wasn't the case when I came back about 3 days later. When I came back at that time, it completely and utterly changed. That this virgin wood was no longer such. And in fact, it was now littered with objects and envelopes and artifacts and binders, but also people had been writing all over the walls, like in marker and in crayon and pencil pen. And what they had been writing on there were some very, very personal and some very heartfelt, accounts, whether it be feeling guilty about leaving a lover or having to deal with bullying, or whether dealing with, let's say, your loss of a loved one. It was this incredible place where you could go, leave whatever it is that you wanted to leave about your issue, and then at the end of the festival, see it all burned to the ground. So it was very cathartic in that way. And it's interesting, like the Black Rock City was a showcase of extreme indulgence and radical self-expression and insanity. But here you had this temple, which was this pocket of unbelievable, maturity and even self-reflection, and kind of like wondering, how can you kind of let go of whatever it is that whatever baggage you're carrying at any given time. And it was a very you could almost feel the pain in the place. It was hard to describe until you actually visited, but there were people openly crying, people just sitting there and rocking and contemplating. There are people deep in prayer, for example. One thing I will say, though, is it did have a very non-denominational feel to it. I didn't see anybody like bring in their particular religious baggage with them. And that's actually something I really appreciated about it, because obviously me being non-religious, being atheist, with obviously these Buddhist proclivities, it was nice to see a place where you could still go and express that side of you, that there is this still kind of emotional, spiritual, existential side. One thing that we've lost, I think, as atheists, is the ability to kind of have a ritual to let go of something. I do think ritual is important to the species and to who we are intrinsically. And I think now I've kind of found an outlet for that. I didn't leave any kind of comment on the walls, or didn't leave any kind of object other than my friend's envelope. Mostly because, I thought to myself, I don't have anything right now. I'm actually okay. I don't have any baggage. But it's good to know that there is this place where if I have something really heavy hanging over my neck, that I can go through this ritualistic practice of, visiting, going. Another thing is that you have to understand is simply the act of getting out there is tremendous. Like, it is such a struggle to get wherever it is. For me, it was Toronto. Even if you're coming from San Francisco or Reno, it is still an ordeal to get out there. And it's the act, and not only is it the ordeal to get out there, it is now that you have to survive once you're there and in extremely harsh conditions. And I think these things are important. They are an indelible part of the experience. And it's like a pilgrimage, if you will, as a result. You have to struggle to get there. And now that you are there, this is the place that you struggle to get to, where you can now contemplate what it is that is hanging on your shoulders and let go of it. And what happens is on the Saturday night, they burn the man, and the man is basically like an effigy of a man, and that's a celebration. That's just a massive set of fireworks and explosions and people screaming and carrying on, and it's unbelievably spectacular and loud. But on the Sunday night, when the temple gets burned, you could hear a pin drop. That's a different vibe altogether. This is more of the cathartic, internal cathartic release and contemplation that happens. So this is where it's kind of like Burning Man as a even like a spiritual retreat, as a kind of mecca for a non-denominational mecca, where you can kind of project onto it whatever it is that you want. Like, look, if you're a diehard Catholic or whatever it might be, whatever your religious background is, you would still find, I think, a home there. But again, it's not the kind of thing you wear on your you wear overtly. You kind of park it at the gates and just kind of bring in your own spirituality, however best you wish to express it there. And yeah, fire obviously plays a very big role at Burning Man. And I think obviously it can symbolize so many different things. It represents not just catharsis and release. It has a kind of even a nihilistic aspect to it. There's definitely an undeniable countercultural element to Burning Man. There is an us and them mentality, both in terms of not necessarily in a good way, but certainly in a very tangible way. This idea that there is, there are those who kind of quote unquote get it when it comes to Burning Man. The idea that you can kind of live in a civilized way, in a simple way, and not necessarily be overburdened by a corporate economy and the whole capitalist backbone, and the whole even the issues with money and gifting. So there's definitely that kind of an element. So this is kind of in a way you can see the burning of everything at the end of it. It can be a middle finger extended to the default world. It can be seen in a way as an expression of angst and frustration that you have to burn it down at the end because you can't really survive longer than, let's say, a week. It's an open question. It's a projection. It can be anything you want it to be. And these are all just kind of things that occurred to me as I kind of partook in the festival. Now, the nighttime at Burning Man is something to be seen. And I'll never, ever in my whole life will I ever forget the first time that I walked out into the Esplanade once it had gotten dark. The Esplanade being the area in the center of Black Rock City that's wide open. And it's kind of like the downtown, if you will, of Black Rock City. But in my life, I've never seen such a spectacle of light and fire and sound. Words do absolutely complete injustice to what it is. And I can remember standing there along with JR next to me. We just stood with our mouths open and just like spinning around, looking at all the fires that were being that were ablaze, or the flamethrowers that were shooting flames like so high into the sky. Everybody wearing glow sticks, and the bikes, having glow sticks around them, and the glowing wire, and just seeing these so many art cars. And the art cars, now that was another thing that completely took me by surprise. I knew that there were art cars there. An art car is any kind of vehicle that's been stripped down and or even just decorated to kind of look fancy and artsy and fun. And these art cars can be everything from a little thing that seats two people through to an entire bus that can have up to like 100 occupants. And what these buses do, or these art cars rather do, is they scoot around the desert area, both in daytime and nighttime, but at nighttime in particular. They flash and they glow. And what's also interesting is they tend to have areas where you can dance. So let's take the top of like an RV would have been completely gutted and rebuilt. They have a spinner spinning on top, and you can dance up there, and that just drives around the desert all night, and it's so fantastic. The music's just blaring. That's another thing. Like, the sound of Burning Man is not anything you can actually understand until you hear it for yourself, because you've got so many people having their own stages, so many cars pumping their own music, and all the other sounds that are a part of the experience. And it provides this unbelievable soundscape. And in fact, I had kind of had this idea that next time I'll bring a recorder with me and just kind of do a walkabout and see if I can pick up these kinds of incredible sounds as you're there. So it's just as much acoustically vibrant as it is visually. And in terms of the nightlife, there's, in addition to the art cars, which, by the way, it's encouraged that you get on the art cars. Like, you hop on the cars, you dance, or you just sit down if there's seats there. You get to meet people, you talk to people, and you could literally, if that's all you did at Burning Man, you would have a fantastic experience. I mean, another thing is you've got to engage in the festival if you want to get anything out of it. If you wanted to just sit back in your camp and kind of feel sorry for yourself and not engage with anybody, well, then that's the kind of experience you're going to have. Me, because I'm a very agrarious person and extroverted, I am out there and I am like meeting everybody, and I'm completely sharing in my experience and wanting to know how their experience are going, and just meeting complete strangers and having an incredibly good time, and meeting an incredible cast of characters, everything from professional drug dealers through to even open heart surgeons through to these young kids that managed just to pool whatever resources that they had to put this little bus together and hit the playa, aspiring artists, dancers, professional dancers. And the list went on and on in terms of the kinds of the people that I met. And that's definitely, you know, a huge part of the experience. So the art cars are definitely the way to go. Lots of spinners and dancing, whether it be, you know, traditional house and dance, but even some good alternative house, some good dubstep. There was some good, even some slow down dubstep, which was really neat. And even traditional bands, like even like folksy bands and rock bands. So whatever you wanted to find, you could find it there. But definitely electronic was definitely a big part of the aesthetic of Burning Man. There's no question about it. The fire dancers were, the only word to describe it was spectacular. These were some unbelievably skilled people who, you know, whether it be a baton that was a flame or a ring of fire that they were dancing with. I could just watch that all night, and it was quite beautiful. Now, another part of the experience, undeniably, the drugs and the sex. And again, the individual either wanted to take part in that or not. I mean, that would be up to the individual burner. I remember I did have one experience that I'll share with you. Not much of a story, aside from just kind of what you could kind of expect there. I was at one point on my own, and I was on top of the phage structure and overlooking, so it was quite high. And I was hit on by a couple of gay guys from New York, very wonderful guys, and very friendly, very touchy-feely type thing. And, you know, I made it very clear at the get-go that I don't swing that way, but I'm willing to kind of keep talking with these guys and just kind of share in what this is all about. And I talked about my kids and how I'm even thinking of bringing my kids along to Burning Man at some point. But then he said, okay, look, here's what I want to tell you. Here's what we do at our camp. We've got a tent set up where we've got basically these heaters set up in case it gets too cold. And we call it the Bonobo Lodge. And what you do is you come in there and you strip down naked, and you kind of join this cuddle puddle in there with both, you know, men, women, so gay, straight, bi-curious, whatever you want. And they said you didn't even have to strip down to naked. If you were just comfortable in your underwear, you could do that. And what you do there is you're basically grooming each other. So he said, like bonobos would. So you can, there's oils there. You can rub oils on your partner or on a stranger. You can comb their hair or just rub them, whatever they're comfortable with. And that's just going to go on all night. And I mean, I think he was perhaps being even a bit reserved in terms of what goes on. I would imagine that there's more to it than just that. And I thought to myself, okay, this you are at Burning Man. This is a time where you're going to be a little out of the box and be a bit more exploratory. And I genuinely told him that I was interested and that I'll definitely consider it. But as once the next day rolled around and I started to think about it, I thought to myself, okay, it's one thing to be open-minded and even exploratory in terms of your attitude, but ultimately you have to ask yourself, is that the kind of experience that you're looking for? Is that what's going to make you happy? Is that the kind of thing that ultimately at the end of the day you can say, yes, that was a satisfying thing for me? And I could say that no, that's not entirely within my comfort zone, and that I might have very well been creeped out by that and made very uncomfortable by it. So I decided to not go. But the fact of the matter is that, again, I'm just sharing a couple of ideas there. One is that that's the kind of opportunity that's available there, and that's not even probably even remotely close to some of the more racier stuff that's available there. But that even as well, that these are kinds of, there were some things that were perhaps beyond what I wanted to take part in while I was there. But that for some people, that might have been an amazing opportunity to perhaps let go a little bit and maybe explore a certain part of them that they had wanted to. That this is the place where no one's going to judge them. It's kind of like whatever stays in Nevada, you know, whatever happens in Nevada stays in Nevada type thing, whether it be Las Vegas or whether it be Black Rock City. And this is another thing, before I forget, about Burning Man, about this not being judged and about kind of finding forms of expression there, is one of the central tenets of Burning Man is this idea of radical self-expression. So you did see some unbelievable costumes, unbelievable art displays, art performances. You also saw a lot of behaviors that you could say were rather outrageous or extremely outgoing and sensational, and that added obviously to the festival. But What was also kind of fascinating about this as well was how, as a result of this, it really was a place where you could have your dignity restored. And I remember there was one night in particular, once I started to kind of get a feel for what Burning Man was about, I decided I'm just going to go out tonight and just kind of go up to strangers and chat them up and kind of ask them what it really kind of means to you to be here and why it's important to you. See, this is my problem. I can't always park this kind of intellectual side. I can't just go, you know, away for a week and just party. I have to suddenly intellectualize everything. And suddenly I was like this sociologist walking around asking people these questions. And some people were uncomfortable by it. A lot of people thought I was a cop, thinking that, you know, I'm trying to find or drugs or what have you. Once I could reassure them that that wasn't in fact the case, I was able to get their trust. And let me give you one example in particular. This was one experience in the whole thing from start to finish couldn't have been more than 60 seconds or so. And it was a woman, and I just went up to her and I said, "So, you know, what does it mean to you to be here at Burning Man right now?" And she said, "Huh." I said, "Now, do you want the short answer or the answer that's going to make me cry?" And I said, "Well, can I have the truthful answer?" And she said, "Well, Burning Man is the one time. It's the one place that I can go to where I can truly be myself." And then we proceeded to give each other a really big hug, a really long hug that lasted for a very long time. And then without saying another word, off we went our separate ways. But it really struck me that moment. And I thought, wow, like, what does that mean? Like, wow, what does it mean to say that this is the only place you can come to where you can have that kind of sense of true self? And that's really kind of remarkable that such a place exists. And like, what does that actually mean? Like, what does it mean to kind of express yourself? And I mean, what I saw personally were people, for example, that what that meant was wearing a rather garish and outlandish costume, or it could have meant not wearing anything at all. And nudity obviously was a very big part of Burning Man. And as the week progressed, it became more people became more and more comfortable with that particular element. It also could be a place, for example, where you can, let's say, engage in drug use in a way that you can't, let's say, in your real life, whether it be on account of your social situation or your job or what have you. And let me give you another story here. On that same night, I was in an art car, and after chatting up the driver of the car, and I convinced him that I wasn't a cop, because again, he thought that was again another case where I was a cop because of my just how open I was. He said, "Okay, well, what about that guy next to you? Like, I've been kind of concerned about him tonight. Why don't you chat him up and see what you think? I'd be curious to see what you have to say." So I said, "Okay." So I looked next to me, and sure enough, there was a guy there that definitely had this kind of fish out of water look. He was about, I'd say, in his late 50s, which was not weird in and of itself, because there were people there of all age groups. But he definitely kind of, he didn't look like he was kind of in the spirit, if you will, of the festival. He had just a regular pair of slacks on and a windbreaker. His hair was very finely put together. And he was just sitting in there very quietly, hand in lap, just kind of looking around. So I started a conversation with him. You know, I asked him what his name was. And he said, my name's Dr. J. I said, "Oh, so why do they call you that?" He says, "Well, that's just what they call me. They call me Dr. J. By the way, in terms of a name like that, that's not too uncommon. Like at Burning Man, there are what are referred to as playa names, which are kind of like nicknames, which is, again, gives a sense of otherworldliness or the sense that there is an alternative world that's happening. So I kept trying to talk to this guy, trying to stir up conversation, and he was just evasive and did not want to carry the conversation any further. So I said, "Okay, fine." And I just kind of ejected myself from that and went back to the driver. And I said, "Yeah, you know, this guy, he is kind of giving me this weird sense. Like, I just can't quite put my finger on it. I don't know what really beyond, you know, what to say about that." At which point the driver kind of said, okay, it's time for me to kind of fess up here a little bit. Let me tell you the truth here. He's actually with us. He's actually a friend of ours. And what you need to know is he is a rather world-famous cardiovascular surgeon who's right now completely tripping out on LSD. I'm like, whoa, wow. And then after managing to hang out with these people even a bit longer, I realized that actually many of them were in fact surgeons and were medical professionals, and they were all, you know, in various states of mind-altered, rather they had whether it had been, you know, drinking or drugs or what have you, they were all just carrying on in this art car and having an unbelievably spectacular time. I mean, the smiles and the joy was incredible. And I got thinking of this man in particular, like, wow, what it must mean to him to be here and to, let's say, do a hit of acid. And I can only imagine what the rest of his life is like. Like, those, what are those other 51 weeks of the year like for him? And I can imagine not quite like that. I mean, it's probably very stressful, very businesslike, full of emotion, I'm sure, and properness and dealing, you know, with patients and with colleagues and peers. And that this is the one place where, you know, you can go out and completely let yourself go. And like I said, no one's going to judge you. No one's going to, you know, talk about this when you get back. And that, I think, Burning Man is definitely another place where, you know, it has all these different outlets for various different things. So that's, you know, this is the one place. Look, if you want 1 week to party of the year and to kind of let it all go, it's definitely, you want to do it is at Black Rock City. That's the place where you do it. So, I mean, I'm kind of running out of time here. We're now definitely over the hour mark, and I could keep going on and on and on about this. One thing I do want to say is get a kind of a sense of the alternative world aspect to it and how it might pertain to futurists. And I got thinking immediately of sustainability, like how long could this kind of vacation world actually last? And one thing that does happen is the festival does degenerate on the very last day. On the Exodus day, things like all the signposts get torn down, and a lot of that kind of civility that had previously characterized the place kind of gets a bit lost. And even that kind of tone, you just feel it got sucked out somehow as everybody's leaving. And kind of one of the theories that's been put out there is that an event like Burning Man could remain intact and keep that civility so long as there's a finite span of time that's been allocated, whether it be 1 week or 2 weeks or 6 weeks, it doesn't matter, but there has to be a finite set of time set up. It's because you know you've got to keep it together. You've got to plan for and work towards keeping your camp together, or the standards together, the supplies together. Otherwise, it falls apart. And I think this is, again, why it works in a desert environment and in a harsh environment, because if you don't, you're quite literally playing with your lives. So that's kind of one aspect to it. Another is the sustainability. I mean, how could you actually have a kind of permanent vacation world? And this is, of course, interest to futurists, particularly those who think about the automation revolution, the end of scarcity, post-work economies and so on. Is this kind of thing viable? Could we actually live in a kind of vacation world for the rest of our lives? You know, would we want to, and could we? And I think it's not something that will happen overnight. I think this is going to be something that's going to be part of a process that sees the because right now, in order for a place like Black Rock City to function, burners have to work and provide the economy in the default world to bring in the wealth, to bring in all the goods, to bring in all the services and their skills and their talents. So it's kind of like, in a way, leeching off the real world. So what would need to happen is that as long as that there's a less of a burden on the burners themselves as it pertains to their engagement in the real world, the longer these kinds of spans of time in a vacation world can happen. So again, these are kinds of open questions, and I think that it's through festivals like Burning Man that we can continue to explore them and wonder, you know, can there be alternative societies? Can they be minimalistic like this? Can you kind of have a very few set of rules and a very few established laws, and even a lack of an infrastructure, and kind of see this kind of wonderful thing emerge just through the efforts of some rather enthusiastic keen individuals. So that was the trip. On the very last day, JR and I, we packed up, we cleaned up the place, got into our van, and we rolled on their way out. We managed to have a very easy exodus. Sometimes you think getting in is bad, getting out can often be much worse. I've heard that there are wait times anywhere between 6 to 10 hours just waiting to get out. And the reason for that is that they don't let all the cars leave at once. They do a thing what's called pulsing, is where they only let a certain amount of cars out at the same time so that it doesn't overburden the highways and the towns in which all the people are leaving in such a short time. But we managed to get out. We left a little bit early, which is why we had no problem. And we got back into San Francisco in a relatively reasonable amount of time. We cleaned up the van before we returned it to the rental agency. And the plane ride home was a rather quiet and introspective one. I was taking notes and writing and thinking as to kind of what this trip meant and what it meant to me personally. And I still feel like I'm processing it. I definitely want to go back. I'm not going to go back next year, but I'm imagining that in the year 2013, I'll go back and I'll definitely rejoin my friends at Future Camp. And it's funny, as I'm looking here at the clock, this has been already about almost an hour and 10 minutes, and I feel like I've only really hit about, let's say, 5% of what I wanted to talk about. So that's actually a good thing, because I definitely would like the whole Burning Man thing to be perhaps an ongoing part of this conversation of what sentient developments is about and what I'm all about. And just to, again, get a sense as to how, can we talk about alternative societies and even alternative customs, different modes of living, different modes of getting along. I mean, as a sociological experiment, it's quite profound. And I definitely feel that you could do many, postdoc, you put like a thesis about it or even an undergraduate thesis about various elements of it. And definitely a place unbelievably rich in detail and possibility. So on that note, I'm going to wrap it up. I do hope that you enjoyed my ramblings on about my trip to Burning Man this year. And like I said, expect to hear more of it in future. In the meantime, have yourselves a wonderful week. And I will look forward to speaking to you again in about a week's time. And until then, you're welcome to contact me, george@sentientdevelopments.com. And everybody, have yourselves a wonderful week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Sentient Developments. Goodbye.